One of the centerpieces of our fellowship life is our principles for a healthy congregation. This is a statement describing how we want to walk together in this diverse spiritual community. And one of the most important lines from that statement is this one. We strive to respect tradition and also embrace change as the needs of our community change. We strive to respect tradition and embrace change as the needs of our community change. And I believe that we have mostly lived up to the aspiration embodied in that statement, and that that's a reason for our success. For if we had shifted constantly depending on the latest winds of change and there had been no continuity, no foundation, I do not think we would have grown in depth and in numbers. People would have come and gone as fast as the latest fad. But if we had been stuck in the way we've always done things, the fellowship also would not have grown. There's no way to grow sevenfold without some serious change happening. When I started in 1990, we were in the 100-year-old former Moose Lodge. I was the only paid person on staff. We had one service each weekend with maybe 70 folks in the building. We were located in an out-of-the-way neighborhood on the periphery of Appleton's downtown. Figuratively, we were also located on the periphery of the Fox Valley. Too small to be much noted. Obviously, a lot has changed. If there had been sustained and widespread resistance to change, we would still be at the Moose Lodge. We'd still have around 100 people. I'd be long gone. Things would indeed be the way we've always done them. So a real secret of success here has been valuing tradition and at the same time, opening ourselves to change, even in aspects of fellowship life, which seem pretty central. We have not ditched traditions lightly, but we have also not been held hostage by tradition. This week I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of our worship services. They, to me, are really a striking example of continuity and change. So I want to run through some of the history of the different elements of our services, at least as I understand the history. So there are some elements of our service that I chose to keep all these years, starting with the basic structure of the service, delineated in the order of service as gathering, sharing, centering, searching, and closing. Those you can see printed in the order of service. That sort of structure actually predates me. Starting our services with enter, rejoice, and come in predates me. So do the chalice words that we use each week when we light the chalice. I think these things were instituted by the Reverend Jacqueline Collins, the extension minister who served here in the latter half of the 1980s. And I want to say, in my view, that Reverend Collins is really an unsung hero of our fellowship story. I believe that the congregational response predates Reverend Collins, and although it's been part of our service for a long time, no doubt it has evolved over the years. I have the impression that in the 1980s, the congregational response was a little more like it's been in a lot of small Unitarian Universalist congregations, overly intellectual with a gotcha quality. People would try to catch the minister in inconsistencies, in mistaken thinking. It was a talk back in the terrible sense of that word. With mostly good reason, congregational response today has a terrible reputation in our UU movement. There was a congregation in this state that once renamed that time Mind Rub. There's a picture. A small, all head, no heart little congregation sitting in a circle, rubbing each other's minds. What could be more horrible than that, as far as I'm concerned? So I think it's important for you to know that the congregational response that's such a centerpiece in our service was mostly killed and buried long ago in our UU movement. The congregations that still do it are small, lay-led fellowships for the most place going nowhere fast. I'm pretty sure there's no other large UU congregation doing it, and I don't even know of a mid-sized congregation still doing it. Now, I think that here, a shift began from that mind rub idea, the talk back idea, into more of a deeper spiritual response. I think that was underway when I came. And I can tell you that I made it my mission to continue that shift. And your ability to do that shift, to keep going on that, is a reason, really the only reason, we still have it in our services. If it had not shifted, I can tell you I would have killed it long ago or headed to the exit doors. I think I introduced the silent meditation and prayer, and I know that I added starting and ending it with the Buddhist gong. And just incidentally, some people have asked, is the gong going with me? No, it's not going with me. I don't know how you're all going to use it, but it's not going with me. The chalice extinguishing words were changed maybe 15 years ago in a way which kept the spirit of the old, but made the words more poetic, less clunky. Many thanks to Deb Andrews, our worship leader today, for being the primary writer of the new set of words. The offering, for those that are new, this was a revolutionary innovation here in the last 10 years. Joys and Concerns remains, but underwent a dramatic reformulation 5 or so years ago, a reformulation that some of you liked and some of you did not like. A few years ago, we added lay worship leaders and mostly shifted the call to gather from a few lines of poetry or prose to a personal story related to the sermon topic, as we heard this morning. Early in my time here, we had a children's story every single week. Mostly the stories, we really made no effort to tie the stories into anything going on in the rest of the service. Then we got rid of the children's story on a weekly basis because we were too crowded in our old worship space here. Now, with the construction of the sanctuary, we're able to do it again every week. We've reformulated it to be a time for all ages, and now we really work to make it work with the sermon theme, as you saw today, I think. Musically, we've moved toward a wider variety of music. For most of my time here, I chose the hymns. And you could tell that a non-musician with little time to choose hymns was doing it, because I would pick the same hymns over and over again until at least I was sick to death of them. Now, with a music director working enough hours, maybe barely enough, to have time to do that task, we have way better hymn selections. Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Karen, before Jay. This year we've had a wonderful musical innovation of adding a children's choir, which has been one of the sweetest things this year for me. As far as holiday services, I started the Mingling of the Waters service the very first weekend I was here. Flower Communion predates me. I introduced the Turning of the Year ceremony at the end of right around New Year's. After I heard the idea from a colleague, I made Christmas Eve more traditional, and I've made the winter solstice a holiday we consistently celebrate. So hopefully you get the point here, that there is a blend of tradition and adaptation and outright change in the flow of our services. This may be obvious, but it's really important also to say that one of the criteria that has guided me in tailoring things in our service, my own skill set, my talents, and my weaknesses. And I would think any minister here would want the freedom to do that. I, for example, and I didn't make this clear yesterday, I love congregational response. That is in my wheelhouse. It's a great part of the service for me. As you move into a time of ministerial transition, let me be blunt then. I think it would be really unfair to my successor to box her or him into doing things the way I've done them. It will be important to my successor's success, I like how those words are related, for him or her to have the freedom to tailor things so that they're in his or her wheelhouse. And there's another word besides unfair to describe it if you box my successor into doing what I did. Stupid. Really stupid. And I looked in the thesaurus for other words, but you get the point. I want to share about another congregation story. I think it's going to be helpful for us. In the last several years, All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has been a fascinating and compelling example of tradition and change, particularly in its services. As recently as 20 years ago, there was possibly no more staid, traditional Unitarian, stuffy service than All Souls Tulsa. Then a really amazing thing happened. First, a number of people in this overwhelmingly white congregation in Tulsa did some serious work understanding their privilege as white people and becoming more competent in intercultural communication. Meanwhile, in town, there was a black charismatic minister named Carlton Pearson, a Pentecostal minister, who built a megachurch. Educated at Oral Roberts University, Bishop Pearson was a traditional black Pentecostal minister. And then he embraced the revolutionary and heretical belief that everyone is saved. Everyone, no matter what you believe, no matter who you are, no matter how you behave. He became, in other words, a universalist. And he lost all but a few hundred of his church members, from 5,000 down to 200. He lost his church building. He eventually turned to All Souls Unitarian Church and rented space from that remnant church. The bonds began to develop even further, and after a few years, his church dissolved and merged with All Souls. So this traditional, overwhelmingly white Unitarian church entered a new incarnation. It became a multicultural, multi-theological church. And they kept the more traditional Unitarian flavor at the first service on Sunday. They transformed the second service into a universalist, Pentecostal-flavored service. And they had two music directors. One of them, the traditional guy, the other, the music director at Carlton Pearson's church. So each church had its musical flavor, but then they began to collaborate and they began to sort of seep into each other's service in a really cool way. Now, this transformation into a truly multicultural congregation is not yet complete at All Souls. And it's not been without significant disagreement, discomfort, and even open conflict. It could still founder, but the truth is that if most folks in this traditional, overwhelmingly white church had been stuck in that, we want to do it the way we've always done it, this transition to a multicultural congregation would have never even started. So I chose the reading today to illustrate how the service in Tulsa has evolved. This poem, along with several other poems shared by Black Slam poets, was part of not only the Pentecostal but the more traditional service. This is one weekend after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson. This type of reading would have been unthinkable at All Souls 20 years ago. But the evolution of the church toward being truly multicultural and the development of relationships between blacks and whites in the church and beyond the church made this possible. It's really partly changes in the service that made the transformation to multicultural possible. And I talk about this today not because All Souls gives an exact template for what could happen here, but what it offers is an example and a story. Many people in this congregation have expressed a thirst for becoming a multicultural congregation. I share that thirst. I would love to have someone like this poet, not here by video, but here in person, connected with us, related to us, share the sermon. I will likely find a multicultural church in St. Louis. I want to be part of such a church. I think it's part of what's going to solve our world's problems. But what I want you to know today is that moving toward a multicultural church did not happen overnight in Tulsa. It didn't just happen because white people in the congregation said, "We want blacks to join." It happened because white folks there, at least some of them, learned about their privilege and worked on increasing their competence in interacting with people from different cultures. It happened because relationships across racial lines, still a radical idea in this country, began to develop. It happened because some white folks in the church, including the ministers, figured out ways to support blacks in Tulsa who were leading the effort for inclusion and justice. And so I think their story has two things, suggests two crucial steps for this fellowship in our effort to become more multicultural. First, white members. We need to do some serious work in understanding our privilege and at getting better at intercultural communication. And don't ask blacks and other people of color to do this work for us. This is internal white work. And it's work that you and I, who are white, need to do. And then second, this fellowship, I think, needs to step up and support blacks and other people of color who are working for justice in the Fox Valley. And in this case, fulfilling our mission to be a leader in social justice is going to look a whole lot like following, not leading. As an overwhelmingly white congregation, we will be a leader locally in racial justice if we follow the lead of blacks and other people of color. We need to ask them, what can we do to support you? If, on the other hand, we charge into the fray with all the answers, with what we think is going to work, with the strategies we think will be best, it's just going to be another example of whites not getting it. So I want to say, and also, several things enabled that Black Slam poet to be part of their service. That work on privilege among whites, showing up in support of blacks in the community working for justice without trying to take over, and an openness to change in the worship services. They did not get to this point directly. They had to work through it for 10 years or more. To open the door to become truly a multicultural congregation, you, as I'm leaving, you're going to have to do this hard work. It is hard work. It's frustrating work, and it's holy work. So here's what I want to say most today. Be careful of what you define as the essence of the fellowship. It's what you define as sacred here. The essence of the fellowship is not the way we've always done it. It's not a particular way of doing joys and concerns, or even doing joys and concerns at all. It's not the congregational response. It's not the building. These are all specific forms, embodiment of the fellowship, but these are not the essence. And the essence is not the way I've done things. If any of you ever whines, but that's not the way Roger did it, my ghost will haunt you. Okay, I'm not really leaving a ghost here, but you get the idea, right? And that's all I've got to say.